Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and today we're going to talk about climate change activism. We've known about climate change for several decades now. The topic is still a political debate topic, and we're going to take calls from you this morning, and we're also going to hear from some climate change activists about what they're doing here in New Mexico to address the impacts of climate change here and also working towards future responses to climate change. We're joined this morning by Jim McKenzie. He is with 350.org, the New Mexico chapter. Bill Dubuis is the author of, most recently, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. And Glenn Salas, he's an engineer, and he is with the New Mexico chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
So I wanted to start, Jim, with you first of all. 350.org is a global organization, a global kind of grassroots organization. You're affiliated with the New Mexico chapter. The name of the organization comes from the organization's goal to bring the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere down from about 400 parts per million to less than 350 parts per million. How do you organize people around a goal like that?
Oh, thank you, Elaine. Yes, it's a challenge, no doubt. What we're trying to do is bring, one, public understanding of the issue. There are a lot of people that understand very clearly what's going on. There's some people that are still sitting on the fence. I think what 350.org brings to the table that's new is some insights that were originally written about by Bill McKibben's in an article in Rolling Stone about a year ago. And what we're talking about is, where is the problem and what do we do about it? And our sense of that is the problem is the fossil fuel industry and their insistence on going it alone with producing carbon pollution beyond what the planet can stand for their short-term gain. And so as an organizer, we're involved in focusing the public's attention on that fact.
Glenn, I want to come to you now. You have a long history of work in the energy industry, nuclear power, the oil and gas industry. Bring your perspective on organizing around climate change. How do you see the goal through your work with the U.S. Green Building Council?
Well, that's a big question.
I'm known for that. Explain it all.
I started out in the oil and gas industry, and then I went to the nuclear industry thinking that might be a little bit better. And I always say that scared me into renewables and energy efficiency. So I've been there ever since. And I think it's just a matter of showing people the way, showing people how it can be done, and reinforcing that there is a problem. It's not just my opinion versus your opinion. There's science that backs it up.
Let's go to Bill Dubuis, author of most recently A Great Aridness. Good morning, Bill. I want to bring you in and talk a little bit about your perspective on climate change as an issue and why it can be so hard for mere humans to wrap our brains around it.
Well, where I start with climate change, and I was at a conference and I saw a man put a map up on the screen and it showed the Southwest as bright red. And what his map was depicting was a model for future water flow, surface stream flow in the Southwest by about mid-century. And I thought, my God, if that map is correct, in my beloved Southwest, this land that we live in, that we all cherish so much, that we, you know, get up in the morning and look outside in this beautiful sky, beautiful land, we're really threatened here. And so my interest in climate change came from just being a Southwesterner and wondering what's going to happen to the environment around me and to my neighbors and to my friends and to the wildlife and the landscape itself. So that's where I got into the issue, and what I found is that people, when they focus on it, understand it, but people are so concerned with so many other things in their lives. They're worried about, you know, their children's health and their grandparents, and they're worried about their job and making enough money and all that kind of stuff. And people, in a way, have a kind of worry quotient. There's only so much they can really be concerned about at a given time. And climate change is this small, this slow-growing kind of danger, and people don't seem to be really well adapted to deal with that kind of danger. If there's a nasty guy coming over the hill with a club in his hands, it gets your adrenaline running, and you respond. But dangers that don't spark changes in your endocrine system, if you will, just don't motivate people enough. And so that's kind of what we're fighting against, and we've got to change that because so much is at stake.
We're talking about the challenges faced by climate change activists this morning on the KUNM Call-In Show. If you'd like to join us, you can call 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Why do you think it's so hard to get policy changes or to get people involved in climate change activism? Where are the barriers in that process in your mind? Again, 277-5866 is the number to call locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 1-877-899-5866. And let's go to Ronald in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ronald. You're on the air.
Good morning, Elaine. So thanks for taking my call. I was really intrigued by the 350 organization. I looked them up when the observatory on that mountain in Hawaii hit 400. And saw they've got a lot of initiatives for slapping the hands of industry to reduce the production of fossil fuels. But I couldn't see that any of the big shots were taking steps to reduce their personal demand. Just like with the illegal drug trade, as long as there's demand, there'll be a supply. Well, I'm out of breath because I'm pedaling my bike on my way to work.
I was going to say, it's
too bad.
It sounds like it.
What do the people in 350 do or suggest that the addicts to fossil fuel do to reduce the demand, which would reduce the production of the companies they advocate against?
Jim.
Yes, that's an excellent question. I think you're not the only one who pedaled here this morning, and that's excellent. You know, I think we've replaced our light bulbs. Some of us are driving smaller cars. In fact, that's the trend nationwide. The problem is, I think, the solutions we're looking for are beyond individual actions. These are societal problems, and they have to become societal priorities. And so that means a policy change. And at this point, the policy changes that need to happen at the national level and to a certain extent at some state levels are being effectively blocked by the powers of the status quo and the fossil fuel industry.
Glenn.
Yeah, and, you know, there have been incremental changes made of a positive nature, but they're not keeping up with the problem. And one of the big areas is buildings, and that's where I am. Almost 50% of CO2 emissions are the result of buildings. And, you know, there are many things we can do to make buildings more efficient, and that's what USGBC is working toward. And locally, you know, we can't step backwards, that's for sure. And locally, the New Mexico State Board of Finance recently took an executive order from 2006 that says, okay, all higher education buildings of a certain size have to be LEED Silver or better. You know, LEED Silver isn't even that great.
Explain what the LEED requirements are. This is LEED, LEED requirements, briefly, for
Leadership
our listeners.
Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design is LEED. And there are, I think, four levels. There's LEED Silver, LEED Gold, and LEED Platinum. And each level is usually more energy efficient and using, you know, more local materials, less energy intensive materials and things like that. So this executive order said, okay, lead silver are better for higher education buildings. Now the New Mexico State Board of Finance comes in and they change the wording to, I don't know, it's a cost-effective, energy-efficient green building practice to the maximum extent possible. What does that mean? You know, if you'd have a LEED building, you know what you're getting. You're getting at least 25% lower energy costs and 19% lower operating costs. If you have a cost-effective, energy-efficient, you know, what does that mean?
So, Bill, I want to bring you back into the conversation at this moment to talk about this tension between long-term thought processes and short-term thought processes. When we're talking about the profit margin for a construction company in the short term versus the long-term impact of saving money or resources when you have a more efficient building. Talk about that perspective with respect to water as you have covered in your book.
Well, the water issue is especially thorny for us in the Southwest. You know, we do need to model good water use, just as we need to, like the caller was talking about, modeling in our personal lives good energy habits. But those individual choices that we make are not going to solve the problem unless we have changes at the macro level. You know, in terms of energy, we really need to reform the economy. We need to move to a new energy basis. And to do that, as Jim says, we need macro policy changes. We need things like a carbon tax that's going to help us shift. And as Glenn is suggesting, the technologies that we need all exist. This is one of the main things with climate change. We know how to do what we need to do, but we need to have the right incentives to get it done. Where water's concerned in the Southwest, things are maybe a little even tougher because we're going to see our water resources shrinking, and that's going to bode very, very ill for agriculture in the Southwest, and we're going to have to see probably some big shifts of water use from agriculture to municipal and industrial, and that's going to shrink agriculture even more.
Well, and we're already seeing that this year with, I believe it's 93% of the state is in it's not extreme, it's exceptional drought. The National Weather Service has added, I believe they've added a new category to the measurement of drought, right?
Elephant Butte Reservoir is functionally dry right now. Carlsbad Irrigation District is getting zero water from the Pecos. These are catastrophes in the making. Texas is suing New Mexico for Rio Grande water and has already appropriated $5 million to litigate the case. If Texas wins that case, the hit taken by agriculture in South Central New Mexico is going to be absolutely horrendous.
And yet, with drought in the Southwest as having been a source of conflict and a source of challenge for agriculture in New Mexico for a really long time, for hundreds and hundreds of years, how do you get people involved in seeing this as something that needs response now as opposed to something that is just the way it is in the Southwest, in the arid Southwest? Jim?
Well, that's a very good question, and if you look at the local press, you'll see a lot of reporting on the drought and, you know, dramatic pictures of dry reservoirs. But what bothers me is that oftentimes the conversation is framed as this is a periodic drought. If we're just patient, we're going to return to what's been the normal. But if we look at the science, what we find is that as the predictions are, as the ice disappears in the polar regions, specifically in the Arctic, that the fallout from that is the change in weather patterns where the kinds of droughts that Bill is talking about here, the catastrophe in terms of the agricultural sector, is going to be the new normal. I mean, this is the drought we're seeing now has been predicted based on the changes in climate patterns.
We are taking your calls this morning. What are you doing in your life or your work to deal with the impacts of climate change in New Mexico? I'm thinking about how so many folks were maybe reminded about their reliance on electricity over the weekend when so many folks had their power cut by the storm that moved through parts of New Mexico on Friday night. There were also folks who had their power cut on Thursday night, the night before, with another storm. And I've heard folks say, you know, I was reminded how much I rely on my electricity service by not having it. What are some of the things that you do? The number to call is 277-5866, locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 1-877-899-5866. You can find us online at KUNM.org. We've got links posted to 350.org, the U.S. Green Building Council New Mexico chapter, and also a link so you can find out more about Bill Dupuy's book. We are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with your calls. This is the KUNM Call-In Show.
I'm Mark Maron. On the next WTF, the mind-blowing comedy mind of Mel Brooks.
There's a great energy that fear can create.
Yeah.
You know, is that guy coming for me? Is that, you know, is that a swastika? What, you know?
Plus, his old pal, Carl Reiner. They still hang out every night. That is beautiful. On the next WTF from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
As summer winds down, we want to know what's happening on your reservation or in your village. What is your tribe or Indian Center doing to help young people get ready to return to school? Is there one last powwow or conference to attend this summer? Are you planting your fall garden? Join us for August current events on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. It's about 21 minutes past 8 o'clock. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and I'm joined this morning by Jim McKenzie with the New Mexico chapter of 350.org. Bill Dupuy is author of most recently A Great Aridness, and Glenn Salas, he is with the New Mexico chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. And we're talking about climate change and what it takes for us mere humans to wrap our brains around such a large global process. And let's go to the phones now. Heather in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if your guests could speak a little bit about the meat industry and CO2 emissions and what they think about that.
Are any of you in a spot where you could respond to that question?
Jim? It's an interesting question. What are the multiple ways that we emit carbon in our daily lives? And the raising of food and meat in particular has an impact, as everything we do. So if I'm buying some hamburger at the supermarket, that's one of the highest carbon footprint foods there are. And I admire people who are drilling down to that level in their lives and changing their personal habits at that level. You know, on a good day, I will eat grass-fed beef, which has a lower carbon footprint than something that comes from a feedlot. It's all over. Our impacts are huge in everything we do.
Let's take another call. Judy in Albuquerque. Good morning, Judy. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I want to bring up the issue of religion in the way humans look at climate change, because on the one hand, looking to God instead of science to, fix all our problems can be a problem in itself. And on the other hand, it seems like a lot of religions are coming around to the custodial responsibility of man toward the planet. And anyway, as far as how, you know, what are the obstacles and the solutions toward climate change, it seems to me that religion plays a big role.
Glenn, your thoughts on that?
Elaine?
Oh, Bill, go ahead.
I agree completely with the caller on that, and I think that a problem as big as climate change, we're not really going to be able to tackle it effectively unless communities of faith really become involved. I'm not myself personally a religious person, but I think that dialogue with communities of faith is so important. And the concept, if one believes in a God, of taking care of that God's creation, of preserving, of being a steward of what that deity has created on this beautiful planet we all inhabit, that's got to be at the core of the ethos of the whole society. And if we really accept that in our hearts, we're going to make changes about how we deal with the world and how we take care of the mountains and the rivers and the plains and the mesas and all the rest around us.
Glenn Salas.
Well, yeah, that's true. And I mean, the religious community is coming around. Last time I was at a big 350 demonstration in D.C., there were a lot of religious leaders speaking because they see that in the Bible it says mankind was given dominion over the earth. It didn't say mankind was given permission to rape the earth.
And then I'm also thinking about something that Bill, you and I discussed a little bit briefly when we spoke earlier about this idea that climate change is a belief as opposed to a fact. Can you tie that in with this discussion about religion and faith?
Well, I think that's what climate change deniers would have people believe, that somehow, do you believe in climate change, as though believing in climate change is optional, like picking a religious faith or a political ideology. The fact is that the science behind climate change is extremely strong, really robust. I mean, everyone is entitled to his opinion, but everyone is not entitled to his own facts. The facts are that the climate is changing, and that this poses a significant challenge to society's very survival, and we have to address it. So, you know, the idea that climate change is just another set of ideas that people can pick up or discard as they wish is a complete red herring. What we're finding is that the climate change models are very robust, they're coming true, and they're holding up except in one very major respect, and that is that the changes that they forecast are occurring faster than the forecast would indicate. And as we learn more about climate change, we're learning that there are feedback loops in the Earth's systems that are reinforcing our movement toward a warmer climate. And that means that we may have even less time than we think to make the fundamental changes we need to make.
So Glenn and Jim were both nodding their heads as you were making that point, Bill. Jim, what was your thought?
We absolutely need the faith-based community involved in this discussion. And I'm happy to report that it's already happened. As you may know, we put together something called the Albuquerque Climate Coalition, and we are organizing a big demonstration for this weekend. One of our principal members and early member of the coalition is the New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light. People get it.
And explain who New Mexico Interfaith Power and Light are.
You know, I think we should get a caller for that. I don't know.
You got it. I'll get that information while we keep talking. We are taking your calls this morning on what impacts have climate change had on you so far in your life here in New Mexico. 277-5866 is the local number to call here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll free 1-877-899-5866. You can email callinshow@kunm.org. You can also post your comments online at kunm.org. Let's go to Maggie in Albuquerque. Good morning, Maggie. You're on the air.
Good morning. I think if we took on a practice of our own behavior down to the micro level of, do I need to drive the car today? Do I am I able to plan multiple tasks in order to take advantage of, you know, the privilege of driving the car? Could I turn off the water while I'm doing dishes? Could I actually collect shower water and reuse it in my garden? So developing personal consciousness to always be aware of the fact that we are now reduced to 6 to 7 inches per annum of rainfall in Albuquerque, down from 9. There's only 11 in Santa Fe, only 14 in Taos. So I think it's getting it into our own personal DNA and our own personal consciousness so that we're sort of embodying the fact that we're citizens of the Southwest and, you know, can't go out and water the grass. And we ought not to be having grass in our communities. So I think that it's not that we're going to personally be responsible for mitigating, you know, just a pound of carbon in our behavior, but it is, you know, getting it out if it's going to happen later or it's not really happening or I can't notice it or these recent rains have filled the aquifer again. It's those things aren't true. We're in a perpetual long-term drought. And if we're going to continue to live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, anywhere in the Southwest, we've just got to take it on personally.
Thanks for your call, Maggie. Let's go to Mickey in Albuquerque. Good morning, Mickey. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. My problem that I have is kind of reversed what everybody's talking about. I appreciate what they're saying, but we're attacking the problem from the wrong end. The end that we have to attack it from is our elected officials, our senators, our congressmen. The reason I say that is they have the power to do these things. That's what it is. The problem, I see it, is that they follow the money for big money, big business, which is changing. The other fact is that we live in a desert, a high desert. A desert means less water. I don't know why people would think otherwise. I went to the city council a number of years ago, and that's exactly what I told them when they were talking about building over on the west side. I said, where are you going to get this water from? This is a desert area, and Mother Nature doesn't care about religion. It doesn't care about many other things that people are concerned about. All it is a fact of life that we live in a desert, and that's not going to change. Who do we speak to find out about these things, but more importantly, to get after our elected officials about it? That's my humble opinion.
Thanks a lot, Mickey, for your call. Jim, your thoughts?
Yes, the.
On lawmakers versus personal action in our own lives.
Well, what we're seeing today, and I think the caller understands this, is dysfunction in government. So if you look in some detail at what Congress did in 2010, which was the last time Congress had a meaningful go-around on the climate change issue, in order to pass and get even close to passing something, they had to get the industries that were going to be impacted by the change to sign off on legislation. That means that Shell Oil, Phillips Petroleum, BP had to sign off on carbon regulation. That means that the Edison Energy, Electrical Energy Industry Association, that means that the American Chamber of Commerce had to sign off on the legislation. And the fallout meant was that what was left on the table was, even if it had passed, wouldn't have anything like the effect that was needed. So the system is broken.
That's exactly right. Elaine, can I throw in one factoid there?
Bill DeBuies, go ahead.
In 2010, when the legislation that Jim was talking about was being considered, according to the New York Times, during the period the legislation was under consideration, big oil and big coal together spent $500 million on lobbying and PR. So that's $500 million. That's an enormous, enormous amount of economic clout. And in order to go up against that and to change things, that's why people really need to get mad, they need to get organized, and they need to educate and speak out.
I want to turn slightly towards the political process a little bit more. President Obama recently gave an address at Georgetown University discussing climate change. That address was analyzed as having more teeth than his previous years in office and discussions of climate change from the White House. One of the things that he said that the president said during that speech was that those who are already feeling the effects of climate change don't have time to deny it. They're busy dealing with it. And there's this, you know, political analysts have said that because it's the second term for President Obama, that we can expect to see more work from the White House that advocates for stronger responses and policy changes in response to climate change. Glenn, you're nodding. Is that an accurate way to think about what's happening on a national scale?
Yeah, I suppose. He is stepping out. And to tell you the truth, his administration has made more changes than any previous administrations. They haven't advertised it too well, and you've heard about some of the bad things, but they've been doing a lot of good things. But yes, I hope he steps out, and I hope he pushes this stuff, and I hope he uses executive orders if he can't get it through Congress. Our previous caller was right about the micro actions, because they're not difficult to take. I think probably the three of us who are on the panel have all taken those actions, and it's not really a change in lifestyle. And by realizing you have to take those actions, you also are buying into the whole thing, and you're buying into electing the right people. So yes, I hope it's moving in the right direction. He's talking about things like bringing the standards for power plants even higher. And that's a great one. That's one of the macro things that's so important for CO2 and for water, because the less efficient the older a power plant is, the less efficient it is, generally speaking. The less efficient it is, the more water it uses, because they've got all this waste heat to take care of.
Glenn Salas is with the New Mexico chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. Let's go to the phones now. George in Albuquerque. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I'm a right-wing Republican, God-fearing Christian fundamentalist. And I am sick and tired of you liberal, hippie, left-wing, pinheaded intellectuals talking about science. There's no science in the Bible. It ain't there. And you're all going to burn in hell. Thank you.
All right.
That's kind of hard to have a dialogue about, isn't it?
Yeah, let's go take another call. Clifton in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Juan. It's fun to follow that fellow.
Well, I think I'd like to mention at this point that I would like to refrain from name-calling in our discussions, and we try to keep it as respectful as possible, even though folks may have greatly differing opinions on the topics on the show. So now, Clifton, go for it.
Real quickly, I am involved with a local group in Albuquerque called Keep It Kirky. We are Albuquerque's Independent Business Alliance. We promote shopping local. And one of the important effects of buying local, of course, is that we generally shorten the supply chain. So when you're talking about all the micro things that people can do, I just wanted to pipe up and encourage people to try to do as much business with locally owned, independently operated businesses who sort of shorten the supply chain, and thus we can collectively have a pretty dramatic effect on the carbon footprint. Thank you.
Maybe, Clifton, if you could go online and post information along with the information from this show so folks can find it. There's a way that you can post comments at KUNM.org when you click on the post for this particular show. We do have an image. I posted an image that was two screen grabs from Earth temperature data starting in the 1880s and then going into the early 2000-teensies, I guess you would call it, 2011. And the image shows the world a little bit blue to begin with, as monitoring some decrease in temperature starting from the early 1880s. And then it's a kind of a time-lapse image that shows the change in temperature over that period of time. And I took one of the earlier ones and one of the later ones. So you can see that image online at KUNM.org, and you can also go to the website and see that time-lapse demonstration in color of change in Earth temperature, which in some parts of the world is about 2 degrees Celsius. Since the early 1880s. Let's take another caller, Wanda in Albuquerque. Good morning, Wanda. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have in front of me a brochure that I got some years ago, and it's dated December 1992, and it's Prominent Signers of the Warning to Humanity. And it's over 1,600 scientists, including 102 Nobel laureates, a majority of the living recipients of the prize in the sciences. They signed the warning. They include 70 countries, all the 19 largest economic powers, all the 12 most populated nations, and so forth. And you would recognize many of these names. And they have a very specific 5-point plan and what we're really facing. Well, that was December 1992. The world population was 5.4 billion people, and now it's over 7 billion people. And I just got a letter from London, and my friend there said they had already had 700 deaths from the heat there. She's hosing down her dogs and putting ice cubes in their water pans and so forth. But at any rate, I don't see that the people in the United States even comprehend. If I am correct, and I believe I am, not one representative from the United States was at the last international climate conference in Africa. It was broadcast by Amy Goodman, and I listened to it, and the other countries could not understand our thinking. I'll hang up and see.
Wait, Wanda, I wanted to ask you a follow-up question. Why do you think that is?
I think because if you check our standing in the world in all sorts of educational standards, we are sinking like a rock. And Americans' general acceptance of science, just as you heard, we're all pinheaded idiots that are going to burn in hell. No, we're going to burn right here on planet Earth. And I don't think that our scientific knowledge, except for exceptional scientists, measures up with our general population. Okay, I'll let you go. I was told to keep this brief.
Thank you. Thanks for your call, Wanda. And I did get a note from my producer that the previous caller was intending to be sarcastic. So we'll have to take I don't know what to say from that. We are going to take a quick break, and we'll come right back to the show in just a moment. This is the KUNM Call-In Show, and we're talking about some of the challenges that climate change activists face these days when working to build support for policy that addresses climate change, to raise awareness about the impacts of climate change here in the U.S. and around the world. And we'll also have some more details about a rally that is planned in several cities across the U.S., including Albuquerque, this weekend. We'll have more details on that. And you can find details about our guests online at KUNM.org. We'll be right back. We'll take a quick break.
Established in 1929, UNM Press is a well-known and respected publisher in the fields of anthropology, archaeology, indigenous studies, Latin American history, American studies, Chicana and Chicano studies, art and architecture, and the history, literature, ecology, and cultures of the American West. For more information, please visit unmpress.com. A message from the tax-exempt University of New Mexico Press.
I'm Stephen Spitz, the host of New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. This Friday morning at 8 a.m., our guest is sculptor Michael Naranjo. Naranjo, a Santa Clara native, appeared destined for life as an artist until he was terribly wounded and blinded by an enemy grenade in Vietnam. He has nevertheless created wondrous works of art, which are now in the collections of major museums. How did he do it? We'll find out this Friday morning at 8 a.m.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. It is 8:44. I'm Elaine Baumgartel, and we're talking about climate change today and activism around climate change. Jim McKenzie is with the New Mexico chapter of 350.org, an organization that has a goal to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere from 400 parts per million to less than 350 parts per million, thus the name. We have also got Bill Dubuis on the line. He is the author of, most recently, A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest. And Glenn Salas, he's an engineer. He's worked in the energy industry for a long, long time, and he's affiliated now with the New Mexico chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. And we're going to go to our phones right now. Aaliyah in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just kind of want to echo the sentiments of that last caller. We really do have a science education problem. I teach biology at the community college in town. And folks don't understand how everything goes together. They're comfortable with evolution and science related to a flu vaccine or predicting earthquakes or the weather, but they're not comfortable when we say, we've known about climate change for 40 years. Pardon me. And I think there's a profit motive built in as well. And so the term I like to use, and I'd like to see spread, is global climate uncertainty, because every sector is made uncomfortable and highly motivated by uncertainty.
So changing the language. I mean, climate change itself is a change in language from the term global warming, right? Jim, can you talk a little bit about the evolution of that? I have always found that interesting.
As a movement, we have been searching for the best formulation, and it's an evolving process. It's still going on. I think we should not be surprised that this is a very, very difficult problem. You know, if we go back to the 1500s, when the Industrial Revolution was taking hold in Europe, coal was an essential part of that, the energy that propelled that change in technology. Coal and water power and other forms, animals, but largely coal. And then sometime in the middle of the 19th century onto the later part of 19th century, there was another transition, and that was to oil. And so these, we've been involved in fossil fuels for many, many centuries. And now we are talking about reducing our fossil fuel use by 80%. This is what the scientists are telling us is necessary. This is a monumental change. And we're all talking this morning about how difficult it is to do this. Well, it's not a surprise. It is enormously difficult, but we have wonderful resources, and if we can bring those resources to bear and get some of the vested interests out of the way, this is something we can do, but it is enormously difficult.
Let's take another call. Lisa in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I represent Citizens Climate Lobby, and we are one of the original groups that's involved in the coalition that's planning the rally on Saturday, rally at the Rio. And what our main, we have one issue, and we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan group, that we are trying to bring a fee and dividend tax to at the national level, and many of your all of your panelists have spoken a little bit about it. I just wanted to clarify it a little bit. And so what it means is that we will tax the fossil fuel industry at its source, which could be at the wellhead or at a mine, and that tax will go straight into IRS, be a brand new line item. There's no new bureaucracy that is necessary to accommodate it, and that money's from that will be generated from that will be returned to the populace, to all the electorate, straight through. And so it's considered revenue neutral. And then each year that will be graduated, that amount of that tax, and it's called a Pigouvian tax, and it's much like was used in the cigarette industry to disincentivize using and buying cigarettes, the same thing as we transition to a new clean energy economy. And as your speakers and panelists said, we already have the technology necessary to live in a clean energy economy, but we need to wean ourselves off of the fossil fuels. And we believe this is a way that is the most efficient to do it. And British Columbia, you can look up, they have had it in effect, and they are seeing a huge decrease in their carbon footprint while at the same time their economy is growing. So thank you very much for hosting this, and thanks to all the panelists.
Thanks for your call, Lisa. Let's go to Don in Albuquerque. Good morning, Don. You're on the air.
Yes. How can we expect corporations and politicians we make radical personal changes in how we live? My own testimony, I enjoy living simply and healthy. I've ridden in no car for 12 years. I've owned no car for 34 years. I love to walk. My home is one sunny 9.5-foot by 12-foot rented room with 6 windows in the house of a friend. In cold weather, my room is heated largely by the sun. Not flown in airplanes for decades. I have no air conditioner. Don't want one. Every day I eat alfalfa and calitus from my garden. Calitus and alfalfa need less water than common garden greens. I wash my clothes by hand. I hang them up to dry. I eat only raw plant foods, no meat, no dairy, no junk food, no cooked food. I have no refrigerator. Don't need one. I have no cooking stove. Don't need one. I enjoy living simply and healthy. I live well. And I say change as fast as you can as long as you enjoy it and are quite sure you will stick with it. I thank you.
Thanks for your call, Don. I want to go back to the panel for a moment. Bill, Jim, and Glenn, this challenge of making change in one's own life and also working to have people in positions of power and authority make change. How do you balance that in your life, Glenn?
Well, I think, you know, Don might be an extreme example, but he's a great example of somebody who seems to be happy with the choices he's made. And, you know, the choices I've made, I'm happy. You know, I have a really good lifestyle, and I use a lot less energy and water than most people. And, you know,
it's not everybody has that freedom or the opportunity to not drive a car, say, if you can't live near your workplace, for example, and the buses don't, you know, our public transportation system is maybe not as convenient as it could be. So, you know, I'm sure you have made some sacrifices that you've made some decisions that perhaps don't reflect your values, right? Because you had to in some way.
Right.
And we all do. To a certain extent, I'm sure there's something that Don does that he wishes he didn't have to do. Maybe. Forgive me, Don. I just have to assume that there's one thing that you wish you could change. but how do you work with people to find where that sweet spot is?
Can I jump in here?
Bill, go for it.
I think it's really important for us to model our own values. But we don't all have to live the same, and we don't want to create a new kind of Puritanism that says everybody has to live this way. What's going to get us out of this fix that we're in with climate change is for people to live their own ethic, however various that may be, but at the same time to join together and to make those political and macroeconomic changes that will restructure the economy, restructure the energy diet of the nation. And the woman who called in and described the tax and div or fee and div program, I think hit the nail right on the head. That's probably the single most effective thing that we can do as a society, is to impose basically a carbon tax, the proceeds of which come back to the people who are the consumers, but a carbon tax that essentially creates incentives for people to make choices to favor smaller carbon footprint production and distribution of energy in the society. One of the tragedies, one of the potential tragedies about climate change is we know how to solve these problems. We have the technology, we know the path, we can see how to do it, but we're not doing it. And we just have to make that change, not just, you know, in personal consumer habits and lifestyle habits, but we need to make that change in our personal political habits and our habits of activism and involvement, in order to get this kind of change affected both at the macro level and at the micro level in our lives.
Jim, how do you get people on board? Let's talk about the rally.
The rally is happening this weekend. A number of months ago, we started talking about the need to become visible in our communities, demanding change, and we've been overwhelmed by the response. We have 20 organizations now that are joining together in a coalition to bring climate change into the front of the discussion. This is what we would call a foundation issue. We have to remember that we live as part of the environment on this planet. We are not above it. We're not outside it. You know, someone years ago told me, do you know, and you should know, what phase the moon is in? Now, if I were to ask the listeners this morning, what phase is the moon in? Now, who of you can answer that? I'm sure a bunch of you can.
Glenn raised his hand.
Right. So the point is, we are connected, and it's easy to be busy looking at your cell phone and your computer and driving your car and forgetting how thin the veneer is of civilization. And so the demonstration, this weekend, is going to bring the issue of climate change to the fore.
So this is a march and a rally, right? You can find information, links to the 350.org organization on our website, KUNM.org. 350NM on Facebook also has details about the events, which include speakers. Albuquerque's Poet Laureate, Hakeem Bellamy, will be reading a poem, and the organizations are bringing folks. Can you give us details on the time, Jim?
Yes, Elaine. We will begin around 10 o'clock on Saturday morning.
And meeting where?
And the location is at the river, and where the Central Avenue Bridge crosses the Rio Grande is where we're going to meet. And we will march across the river. We have signs, or bring your own signs, and then we reconvene, and we have a very interesting group of people scheduled to speak. We're going to have music, poetry, and be in public, in people's face.
Jim McKenzie is with the New Mexico chapter of 350.org. Bill DeBuise, author of most recently A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the American Southwest, joined us by phone from northern New Mexico. And Glenn Salas, an engineer and with the New Mexico chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council. Thanks to you all for joining us this morning.
Thanks a lot, Elaine.
Thank you.
We will post the audio from this show on our website, KUNM.org. If you have comments about the show or suggestions for future show topics, you can email callinshow@KUNM.org. Find us on Facebook. Just search for KUNM Radio. You can follow the newsroom on Twitter at KUNM News. You can follow me on Twitter at KUNM Elaine. Thanks for joining us for the KUNM Call-In Show. This is KUNM, news and music that connect from the University of New Mexico.